going to look this morning at a long passage from verse 33 of chapter 11 through to 12, verse 3. And in view of the fact that time has just slipped by a little bit, I'm going to just read the closing verses of that assigned passage, chapter 12, verses 1 to 3. Meanwhile, when a crowd of many thousands had gathered so that they were trampling on one another, Jesus began to speak first to his disciples, saying, "Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. There is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed, or hidden that will not be made known. What you have said in the dark will be heard in the daylight, and what you have whispered in the ear in the inner rooms will be proclaimed from the housetops. This above all, to thine own self be true, and it must follow as the night the day. Thou canst not then be false to any man." Many of you, I'm sure, are familiar with those lines from Hamlet on the supreme importance of integrity to human character. I've often thought they were among the wisest lines Shakespeare ever wrote. As a playwright, of course, he must have been more familiar than most with the business of acting a part. And as a student of human behaviour, he had clearly observed that such theatricals aren't confined to the stage. All too often, the image we project of ourselves is an artificial one, a role we play for the benefit of others, which isn't really us. I remember some years ago now hearing a young undergraduate girl who had got mixed up in drugs and who came to see me ostensibly about that, confessing this very point about herself. She said, "When I go home in the vacation, I am the decent, respectable, virginal daughter my parents want me to be. When I come up to college, I become a wild, dissipated, permissive junkie." And she said, "The worst thing about it is, I don't know which is the real me." As our conversation progressed, it wasn't difficult to discern what was going on in this young lady. She was an insecure girl. She lacked self-confidence. And consequently, she was desperate to feel accepted and affirmed by others. And in order to achieve that acceptance and that self-affirmation, she compliantly assumed whatever character those others wanted her to have. For her staid family in Surrey, she played the role of a virtuous Lucretia. For her wild friends in Cambridge, she played the role of a licentious Messalina. At the root, as Shakespeare so eloquently expressed it, her problem was she was not being true to her own self. And as a result, she was being false to everybody. Life had in fact become for her a farcical comedy of errors in which she furiously exchanged one disguise for another in a ludicrous attempt to sustain this double life she'd created for herself. And in the midst of that crazy pantomime, she was inevitably falling victim to a kind of self-inflicted schizophrenia, losing contact with her own identity. "I don't know which is the real me," she said. I even discovered that in coming to me, she found herself assailed with doubts about whether she wasn't just adding another role to her repertoire, that of the guilt-stricken penitent longing for priestly absolution from the local Baptist pastor. I had a lot of sympathy for that young student. I suspect we all do. Because one way or another, all of us fall victim to the same trap of inconsistency and unreality, don't we? As I tried to explain to her, she did have one thing on her side. At least she was aware of this pattern of pretense she had woven about herself. At least she was suspicious of her own motives, critical of her own insincerity, fearful of the long-term consequences it might have on her as a person. Play-acting she may have been, but at least she knew it. At least she was still searching for some nobler stance of inward honesty. At least she still wanted this above all, to be true to herself. Sadly, that isn't always so. There are some who fix the mask of the actor so securely to their faces, they not only forget what they really look like, they give up looking. Pretense becomes so habitual they're no longer conscious that it is pretense. They practice double standards. They speak double talk. They live a double life.
by some extraordinary feat of moral blindness, they feel no pangs of guilt about their duplicity. On the contrary, they frequently contrive to be sanctimoniously self-righteous people. And tragically, I fear there's no sphere where that kind of smug self-deception is more obvious, more discreditable than that of religion. The church is full of hypocrites, says the wise man in the street. And tragically, all too often, the jibe is true. Well, this morning, our Bible study demands of us ruthless self-examination on this very issue. Jesus wants to talk to us about the peril of hypocrisy. He perceived, too, the amount of play-acting that went on in the world, particularly the religious world. Hypocrite, literally in the ancient world, was an actor. That's what the word meant. A person who wears a false mask in order to play a role. And Jesus, perhaps more than Shakespeare, understood the spiritual danger inherent in such behavior. At the end of the day, he wants to tell us the curtain will come down on our performance. The mask will be removed. And then, he says, the secret thoughts and intents of all hearts will stand revealed. On that day, to be numbered among the actors, to be numbered among the hypocrites, will be just about the worst fate imaginable for a human being. Beware of the yeast of the Pharisees, he says, which is hypocrisy. Now, study this morning throughout this long section from 11 verse 33 to 12 verse 3, I think, is an excursus in which that solemn warning is developed. It divides very easily into three parts, as you will see. First, in 11 verses 33 to 36, Luke brings together some sayings of Jesus which I think are about the importance of integrity. We'll call that the remedy for hypocrisy. Then in the longer section, from 11 verse 37 through to the end of chapter 11, we find Jesus unmasking the inconsistencies of lifestyle and attitude which he observed within the religious establishment of his day. We'll call that the characteristics of hypocrisy. And then finally, in that short section at the end that we read, we find him turning to his disciples in the press of popular acclaim and warning them solemnly of the awful peril of hypocrisy. Let's look first, though, at where he begins in verse 33 with the remedy for this awful disease. No one lights a lamp, he says, and puts it in a place where it will be hidden or under a bowl. Instead, he puts it on its stand so that those who come in may see the light. Your eye is the lamp of your body. When your eyes are good, your whole body also is full of light. But when they are bad, your body also is full of darkness. Middle Eastern people love proverbs. And Jesus, like any Jewish sage, was a master of inventing them. And these two verses are cases in point. It's always difficult to be absolutely sure what proverbs are about. What is Jesus getting at? They're rather cryptic, these metaphors, aren't they? But that's part of the intention of a proverb, of course. A proverb is meant to be tantalizing and provocative and enigmatic. It's meant to be applied to a variety of different contexts, where it always operates so as to fertilize the imagination or challenge the wits. It's clear, I think, from the Gospels that Jesus used these proverbs on a number of different occasions, different contexts, meaning slightly different things. Well, the first one, for instance, in verse 33, is quoted by Matthew in the Sermon on the Mount as a statement about God's desire for his people to be witnesses to the world. The purpose of a lamp is that it should illuminate the house, he says. The purpose of you, my disciples, is that your light should shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. But in Luke here, by putting that proverb in conjunction with this second one in verse 34, Jesus puts a much more individualistic cast upon its meaning. It's not just the world that is unilluminated when we fail to exhibit the light we should. We ourselves, he says, are plunged into darkness when we fail to absorb the light we should. Verse 34, your eye is the lamp of your body. When your eyes are good, your whole body also is full of light. But when they are bad, your body also is full of darkness. Jesus here then likens the human personality to a house lit by twin lanterns, the eyes. If the eyes are doing their job properly, he says, the whole person is enlightened. If they don't, the whole person is benighted. I think Jesus is implying in these proverbs there are two ways in which that kind of ophthalmic malfunction can occur. From the first proverb in verse 33, he seems to suggest that we can deliberately shut our eyes, put the lamp under a bowl, so to speak, and so deny light to those who enter the house. I suspect that may well be an allusion back to the unbelief of the Jews that we were examining last week, who, you remember, in spite of Jesus' miracles, refused to accept his unique authority. They just shut their eyes to it. The light was there shining away, set on a lampstand for all to see, but they preferred to live in the darkness, to put a bucket over it. Verse 34, on the other hand, in my view, points the other way, to another manner in which the light can be obscured in us. Not because our eyes are deliberately shut, maybe, but because there's a fault in the eye mechanism itself. As Jesus puts it, your eyes may be bad. And I suspect Luke intends that as a pointer forward to the hypocrisy of the Pharisees, which he's just about to talk about. The connection, I think, really hinges on understanding the adjectives that Jesus uses there, which are rendered good and bad in verse 34. See, when Jesus says, if your eye is bad, he literally says, if your eyes are evil. Rather strange word to use of the optic, until you realize that the evil eye was an idiom well known among Jews in the first century for an envious, mercenary disposition. And if you look down to verses 39 and 40, you'll see it was just such a grasping, selfish attitude which the Pharisees displayed in their hypocrisy. Inwardly, says Jesus, you are full of greed, extortion, and evil, wickedness. The evil eye was a characteristic of the Pharisees. Even more significant, when Jesus says in verse 34, if your eyes are good, he literally says, if your eyes are sincere. Using a word, rather unusual word in some ways, that conveys the idea of guilelessness, candor. Once again, that's a rather surprising word, until you realize that Jesus is just about to expose the insincerity of the Pharisees. In fact, the background to this whole word picture that he's using in these proverbs relies on the Middle Eastern belief, I think, that you can tell a lot about a person's character from their eyes. Shifty, squinted, glazed eyes are not to be trusted. They conceal crafty wickedness. But a steady, open, generous eye, that is the outward sign of an artless goodness. So Jesus is saying here, make sure you've got sincere eyes, so the light within you isn't darkness. If your whole body is full of light and no part of it dark, it will be completely lighted as when the light of a lamp shines on it. Seem to see then why I suggest the purpose of these admittedly rather puzzling proverbs is to urge upon us the importance of personal integrity. Make sure you're a man or woman with sincere eyes. That singleness of vision that eschews dissimulation and deceit, that speaks a heart, as we might say, of transparent honesty. A person like that's an illumined soul. There are no barriers in them to the light of God's self-revelation. But once you allow the duplicity and the selfishness of the evil eye to characterize you, why then you cast a moral shadow over your whole personality. All sorts of dark secrets lurk concealed in the hidden places of a hypocrite's heart. And the irony is, he may not even be aware of it. Just as a blind man may not be aware of his blindness. He claims he sees. He says he possesses the light. When in fact, says Jesus, the light he says he possesses is just a pretense, hiding the true spiritual benightedness of his soul. And I think it's to illustrate that very point that Luke goes on to tell us how Jesus unmasked the moral darkness of the religious establishment of Jesus' day. Here is just the sort of thing that happens when people forsake personal integrity and start playing church, like actors on a stage. So we come to that longer central section, the characteristics of hypocrisy. But verse 37. When Jesus had finished speaking, a Pharisee invited him to eat with him, so he went in and reclined at the table. But the Pharisee, noticing that Jesus did not first wash before the meal, was surprised. Then the Lord said to him, "Now then, you Pharisees, clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you are full of greed and wickedness." If you examine the section here, this central section of our passage carefully, you'll see that Jesus actually engages with two distinct but not unrelated groups of people in the course of it. From verse 37 to 44, he's dealing with the Pharisees. Then from verse 45 to 52, you'll see, it's the experts in the law, or the scribes, as we would perhaps more normally call them, who are being dealt with. The Pharisees were a party of fundamentalist laymen. They were passionately committed to the inerrancy of the Bible. They were diligent Sabbatarians. They were ardent churchgoers. They were zealous in personal prayer and acts of charity. In short, if they were in Cambridge today, there's a high probability they would be members of Eden Baptist Church. The scribes, on the other hand, were professional Bible students. They made their living by the scrupulous attention they gave to the text of the Old Testament, and by the painstaking scholarship of their interpretation of its requirements, much of which relied on the mastery of centuries of oral tradition within Judaism. They gave public lectures in the temple, they taught classes of students in private, their advice was often sought on matters of legal jurisprudence. They were, as we would say, academics. Some of them became quite famous in the country because of their academic prowess. So if they were with us in Cambridge today, there's a high probability they'd be attached to the divinity school of the university. And in view of their special interest in biblical studies and their general theological conservatism, I'm sure they would be regular visitors at Tyndale House Library. As classes of people then, scribes and Pharisees are not unique to first century Judea. You know, I want you to grasp this morning is that they bear an uncomfortable similarity to precisely the sort of people we are this morning. That grieves me to say it, the subversion of true spirituality that they represented, and which Jesus is here so ruthlessly exposing, is all too common within the Bible-believing evangelical constituency to which Eden belongs. It's very easy, you see, when you read these six words, to relate them to everybody else but yourself. You've probably heard me tell before the story of the Sunday school teacher who was telling the story of the parable and the tax man, which occurs a little bit later in Luke's Gospel, to her Sunday school class. In that parable, we find the Pharisee standing in the temple, praying complacently, "Lord, I thank you that I'm not like other people, adulterers, evildoers, thieves." The lesson went on, and then eventually the Sunday school teacher concluded her lesson by saying, "Now, children, let's thank God we're not like that proud Pharisee." It's as we've already said, one of the major characteristics of hypocrisy is that it thrives on self-deceit. So we need to beware this morning as we listen to Jesus bemoaning the marks of hypocritical piety within the religious establishment of his day, lest we find ourselves under the same condemnation. This isn't a situation where we can afford to point at others and say, "That's them." This is a passage when, like the disciples around the Last Supper, we must be constantly asking, "Is it I?" For if anybody are the scribes and the Pharisees of the 20th century, it must be us. Let's look then at what the characteristics of hypocrisy are. The first Jesus gives us is this. Hypocrisy, he says, is preoccupied with externals to the neglect of inward goodness. Look again at verse 39. "You clean the outside of the cup and the dish, but inside you're full of greed and wickedness. You foolish people! Did the one who made the outside not make the inside also? But give what is inside to the poor, and everything will be clean for you." Now, the background of this incident is the ceremonial washing, which the law of Moses laid down in cases of certain kinds of ritual defilement. Often these washings can be shown to have had a rational basis in personal or public hygiene. But such considerations were not the issue for the Pharisees. Ceremonial washing for them was one of the ways they exhibited their religious fanaticism. The scribes had developed a whole complex system of ritual ablutions, which a really pious Jew had to fulfill, far in excess of anything that Moses laid down. And the Pharisees were scrupulous in their observance of all these rules. But clearly Jesus wasn't, hence the raised eyebrow of verse 38. The Pharisee was surprised, noticing that Jesus did not first wash before the meal. How could a rabbi disregard the demands of ceremonial purity so blatantly? Well, for Jesus the issue is quite simple. God, he says, is the creator, not just of the external appearance of a man, but of the inner nature of a man. Sanctity, which he is really looking for, then, is that which expresses itself not just in clean hands, but in a clean heart. Give what is inside to the poor, and everything will be clean for you, he says. Now, biblical critics make much of the fact that Matthew's version of these verses is different from Luke's. Matthew's version of these verses in Matthew 23, verse 26, says, cleanse what is inside. Whereas according to Luke, Jesus says here, give what is inside. I think what lies behind that difference is that in fact Jesus originally made a pun in the Aramaic language that he was speaking. A pun on the similarity between the words for cleansing and giving. And what has happened is that Matthew and Luke, unable to reproduce the pun in Greek, have each opted for a different sense of the original wordplay that Jesus used. But the general point remains the same. The Pharisees' preoccupation with these ritual ablutions was, in Jesus' mind, a giveaway to the kind of mindset they had. Cleanliness for them was not just next to godliness, it was godliness. And that's the way hypocrites think. They go through the motions of external religious piety, but they fail to demonstrate real inward goodness, as, for instance, by the self-sacrificial generosity they might show towards the hungry. I wonder if Jesus would say the same thing to us, then. True, we don't go in for ceremonial washings, but we do have our little methods of externally labelling ourselves as Christians, don't we? The bowed head before we eat our dinner. Bible under the arm, conspicuous on the way to church. The religious cliché that replaces yours sincerely at the end of our letters. The text on the wall. The sticker in the car window. The badge in the lapel. Nothing wrong with such things. We can even justify them as witnesses to the pagan world around us. But then, of course, the Pharisees would have justified their ritual ablutions in the same way. They were witnesses too. The real test, you see, is what's going on inside. Is the house really clean? Or are these external signs just a smokescreen to hide the fact that all the dirt has been swept under the carpet? That brings us to the second characteristic of hypocrisy Jesus gives us in his list. Hypocrisy, he says, is also preoccupied with legalistic details to the neglect of major moral issues. Look at verse 42. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you give God a tenth of your mint, rue, and all other kind of garden herbs, but you neglect justice and the love of God. You should have practiced the latter without leaving the former undone. The tithe, again, was laid down by Moses. It required Jews to contribute a tenth of their income to the support of the priesthood. But once again, the scribes had developed it into a tiresome routine, whereby the really pious Jew could not only give 10% of his money, but 10% of everything, including even the bunches of herbs that were hanging in his kitchen to flavour his dinner. Of course, this kind of pedantic attention to trivial detail is very well documented by psychiatrists in our century. They would often see it as a symptom of an obsessional neurosis, wouldn't they? And the driving force behind such compulsive behaviour, they say, is usually as a way to avoid guilt. All of us, they say, deep inside, know we are moral failures. And one easy and convenient way to escape the personal devastation of facing up to the fact that we are moral failures is to concentrate on the observance of lots and lots of little rules, which, though irksome, can be fully performed. In that way, we can distract our attention from all those nasty big rules with regard to which our obedience can never be satisfactory, and which consequently constitute an inexhaustible source of moral anxiety for us. To put it simply, legalism is just a substitute for repentance. The right thing to do with guilt is to face up to it, to admit it, to look it right in the eye and bring it to God, and accept the shame and the humiliation involved. Take the risk of doing that. If we can't afford that risk, well, then legalism provides us with a convenient alternative. It's not, says Jesus, what you Pharisees are doing that's wrong. It's the reason you have for doing it, you see. It's just a way of evading the full force of God's moral requirements on your life. He puts it very graphically in Matthew's version of these words. He says, you strain out the gnat from your cup of tea, and then you swallow a camel. Once again, I wonder if he would say the same to some of us. I agree there's probably very little evidence of diced mint in our offertory bags this morning. But there are plenty of obsessional personalities within the church who use similar tactics to avoid the big moral issues of our day. God, you know, is really much more interested in how you and I react to issues of social justice than how we react to a spot of dirt on the church carpet. He's much more concerned to know that our lives are dedicated in sacrificial love to Him than that our charitable giving should be calculated in our money books down to the last penny. The big things are what matter to Him. And that brings us to the third characteristic of hypocrisy, which Jesus expresses here. Hypocrisy, he says, is preoccupied with gaining applause to the neglect of having a positive moral influence on other people. See, he puts that in verse 43 and 44. Woe to you, Pharisees, because you love the most important seats in the synagogue and greetings in the marketplaces. Woe to you because you're like unmarked graves, which men walk over without knowing it. Now, we know from other comments in the Gospels that this delight which the Pharisees took in their public reputation went sometimes to quite ludicrous lengths. I mean, not only, as Jesus says here, did they always make sure they had the front pew in the church and greeted one another in this extravagant way in the marketplaces so that everybody had plenty of opportunity to notice them. But that was only half of it. You could add to that their grandiloquent prayers offered on the street corner in a very loud voice, their ridiculously ostentatious clothes, specially designed to parade their faithfulness to Scripture, their pompous giving to charity, employing a trumpeter to sound the way before them so everybody knew what they were going to do. Perhaps most farcical of all, their exhibitionist display of mauvaise honte, as the French would say, false shame, when they fasted, exaggerating the signs of austerity with cosmetic applications of ash, so their humiliation was duly noted by the general public. One could go on and on. Their entire religion was performed, according to Jesus, for the praise of men. But ironically, the very people they were trying to impress by all this performance, they were in fact subtly corrupting. You are like unmarked graves, he says, which men walk over without knowing it. To touch a corpse, you see, was ritually defiling, according to Jewish law. So cemeteries were always clearly marked. An unmarked grave represented a hazard to a Jew, rather like a concealed pothole might to a hill walker. Now, says Jesus, you Pharisees, you're walking unmarked graves. Because you decorate your lives with all this sanctimoniousness, nobody realizes the dead bones that are there. People are influenced by you, emulate you even, respect you. I think that by doing so they're getting nearer to God, when in fact all they're doing is becoming more and more unacceptable in God's sight, more and more defiled. It's a frightening thought, but would he say the same of us? Inevitably people are going to judge Christianity from what they see in us, aren't they? Is the picture we give a true one? Is our influence a healthy one? You are the salt of the earth, Jesus said to his disciples. But if salt has lost its salinity, it's good for nothing. Is that his verdict on us? That we breed corruption in the world, not holiness. You would have thought that such a triad of damning woes was enough. Hypocrisy is preoccupied with external performances to the neglect of inward goodness, he said. It's preoccupied with legalistic details to the neglect of major moral issues. It's preoccupied with gaining applause to the neglect of a positive moral influence on others. But Jesus is spurred to deliver three more woes. This time, it's the scribes that come into his gunsights, isn't it? Verse 45, one of the experts in the law answered him, "Teacher, when you say these things, you insult us also." "Too true," says Jesus, "I do." "You experts in the law too, woe to you." Why? Well, in their case, he says, first of all, because hypocrisy makes religion arduous and unattractive to people. Verse 46. "You load people down with burdens they can hardly carry. You yourselves will not lift one finger to help them." Now Jesus here is referring directly to that mass of legalism and casuistry which was the scribes' stock in trade. According to the psalmist, you know, the study of the Bible should be a delight. God's law in particular, he said, should be sweeter than the honeycomb to our taste. But the scribes had turned biblical religion into desiccated, dried biscuits. A tedious and laborious catalogue of thou shalt and thou shalt not. They made people think they couldn't be acceptable to God unless they dotted every I and crossed every T of their impossibly complicated ethical system. And when the Bible offered men mercy, what did they offer? Rules. When the Bible offered forgiveness, what did they offer? More rules. When the Bible offered grace, what did they offer? Still more rules. Why? Because it was in their professional interest, of course. They were lawyers, after all. The more rules, the better for a lawyer. Isn't that so? They weren't really interested in people's spiritual welfare. They were just interested in their own professional power base within the community. They wanted to remain important. The more rules they were, the more important they were. They didn't want to work themselves out of a job. Who would? I look at myself and I wonder whether he would ever say that of some of us who present ourselves as teachers and theologians. We who make such a point of our devotion to biblical exposition. Do we make the Bible dull and wearisome? Would he say of us, we've turned Christianity from a religion of joyful emancipation into a laborious bondage of do's and don'ts? Makes you think. But there was something even worse, wasn't there, about these scribes? Fifth in his catalogue of six, says Jesus, hypocrisy makes religion intolerant and incapable of change. Look at 47. "Woe to you, because you build tombs for the prophets, and it was your forefathers who killed them. So you testify that you approve of what your forefathers did. They killed the prophets, you build their tombs." It's a stingingly ironic accusation, and yet there's no question of its legitimacy. Down through the history of the Jews, time and time again, it was the religious establishment
the forefathers, as it were, of the scribes, who persecuted the spokesman which God sent to his people. Amos was threatened by Amaziah, the priest of Bethel. Jeremiah was beaten up and placed in the stocks by Pasha, the chief of the temple of Jerusalem. In fact, according to Jewish tradition, the majority of the prophets ended their lives as martyrs. And as often as not, it was the professional theologians of their day who lit the fire under them. Bible students, though they protested to be, they were the very last people to be able to recognize divine inspiration when they heard it. They were prepared to canonize dead prophets, says Jesus, but living ones, you execute. Why? Why, because they were not really interested in hearing the contemporary voice of God. They wanted a domesticated Bible, locked safely away in their university libraries, where they could control how people used it. A living word let loose among the people, that's far too revolutionary, far too challenging, far too unsettling. It demands change. And the scribes had a vested interest in maintaining the status quo. It's precisely the same in Jesus' day. As he goes on to explain, Galilean peasants would recognize his messiahship. Roman centurions would recognize his messiahship. Blind beggars, demon-possessed lunatics would recognize his messiahship. But the theologians of Jerusalem? No. They would conspire to nail him to a cross. God in his wisdom said, I will send them prophets and apostles, some of whom they will kill, others they will persecute. Therefore this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that has been shed since the beginning of the world, from the blood of Abel to the blood of Zechariah, who was killed between the altar and the sanctuary. Yes, I tell you, this generation will be held responsible for it all. Abel and Zechariah here really stand as symbolic figures for what you might call the A to Z of biblical martyrology. From the beginning of the Old Testament to the end, people who spoke for God by the righteousness of their lives and by the divine authority of their words paid with the price of their lives. And says Jesus, this generation will prove no different. Indeed, he predicts this generation will commit the final and most appalling act of homicidal sacrilege of all. One can't help but recall those poignant words in the parable of the vineyard, which he would soon be telling on his way to Jerusalem. He sent a servant to them, but they beat him up. He sent another, but they treated him shamefully. He sent yet a third, and they wounded him and threw him out. What shall I do? Says the owner of the vineyard. I will send my son. Surely they will respect my son. But when the son arrived, they said, this is the heir. Let's kill him. And the inheritance will be ours. So they killed him, says Jesus. That this generation will be held responsible for the blood of all the prophets that have been shed since the beginning of the world. This generation will be held responsible for it all. Frightening words. But would he say the same of us? So secure in our biblical orthodoxy, so smug in our evangelical theology, could it be that we, like the scribes, wouldn't recognize the Christ if he walked through our own front door? The Baptists may have never executed any prophets, you know, but to my knowledge, they have crucified quite a few preachers. We do well to ask, is it I? And that brings us to the final of these six characteristics of hypocrisy in verse 52. Hypocrisy, says Jesus, renders saving truth inaccessible, both to the hypocrites themselves and to those who depend upon their testimony. Woe to you experts in the law, he says, because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered, and you have hindered those who were entering. Perhaps Jesus regards this as the most damning accusation of all. I imagine Luke must have done to place it at the end in this way. They've locked the door of the kingdom of God and thrown away the key. Searching souls who come to them because of their reputation for biblical learning not only go away empty-handed, says Jesus, but positively obstructed in their spiritual quest. For instead of the attractiveness of biblical religion, they find only a burdensome legalism. Instead of a life-changing encounter with the prophetic word, they find only murderous intolerance. Instead of the saving knowledge of divine truth, they find only the disillusioning, dead end of the religious establishment. Would he say the same of us? We who talk so much about the way of salvation, do we know how to get there ourselves? Blind guides, Jesus said of them. You not only fall into the ditch, you take others with you. How surprising is it that the scribes and the Pharisees were stung into hostility by this denunciation of their religion? We find in the last verse, the Pharisees and teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. They'd prove what a charlatan this upstart from Galilee was. Too late. The word is out. His sensational repudiation of the conventionalities of Jewish piety was already spreading like wildfire. A crowd of many thousands had gathered, so they were trampling on one another. Do you notice how Jesus reacts? This is so important. He sees that crowd, and immediately, instinctively, he senses danger. Watch out, he says. Be on your guard. Almost as if, you see, his own disciples, by this flattering adulation of the masses, could be lured into precisely the same kind of spurious religion that he had just been condemning. The scribes and the Pharisees don't stand on their own. We're all vulnerable. So he says, be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. There's nothing so subtle or insidious as yeast. You see, a tiny grain of it can transform the whole lump of dough. It's the same with hypocrisy, suggests Jesus. It creeps in without you realizing it. It feeds, as we said earlier, on self-deceit. And nothing fosters the growth of that self-deceit so quickly as a crowd. It's the crowd always, isn't it, that generates hypocrisy. So he said of that young undergraduate at the beginning. It was her desire to be accepted, to feel affirmed by the crowd that made an actor of her. No one plays an act unless there's an audience to be taken in by it. The peril of hypocrisy would never threaten us if it weren't for the crowd. That says Jesus, there is one person. One person who, while he watches our performance on the stage of life, just like the crowd does, is never fooled by the false images we present upon it. He sees the facade of affectation. He sees the mask of pretense. He observes the hidden inconsistencies. He discerns the ulterior motives. He perceives the secret fraud. He is never deceived. You never pull the wool over his eyes, says Jesus. And one day, to our intense embarrassment, he intends to tell all, warts and all, the truth as he sees it. There is nothing concealed that will not be disclosed, or hidden that will not be made known. What you have said in the dark will be heard in the daylight, and what you have whispered in the ear in the inner rooms will be proclaimed from the housetops. See, at the end of the day, God will only reward reality. He's not offering Oscars for actors who've won applause. He's offering crowns for disciples who've carried a cross. That's why we find on six occasions Jesus bewailing the hypocrisy of the scribes and the Pharisees in these terms. You foolish people, he says, woe to you. See, that woe isn't a cry of anger or even of menace. It's a cry of anguish. It's a cry of grief. This was the word. They wailed over a coffin at a funeral. Jesus pities the hypocrites for all his hard words to them. He sees them as pathetic. Doomed to have their delusions shattered by the awful blast of judgment. That's the peril of hypocrisy. If it isn't unmasked now, it will be one day. I don't know about you, I find this whole thought one of the most searching you ever encounter in Jesus' teaching. Surely the greatest spiritual peril we face, we who come to church, we who study the Bible, who, like the scribes and the Pharisees, have an image of religion about us. Surely the greatest peril we face is that of false security, which thinks that an image is good enough, that an image will get us to heaven. Now God is going to judge us. He's going to expose the secrets of our lives. The words we've whispered in seclusion, he's going to shout from housetops. The thoughts we've entertained in private, he's going to parade in public. The whole moral cesspool of our hearts, which we keep so carefully covered by this mask of good manners and Christian education. There's nothing hidden from God, and he's going to tell all. I say, all our moral Christian respectability on that day will be about as useful as Salome's seven veils in a force 10 gale. What's the remedy? This is an awful peril Jesus is warning us of. And he's not warning the world. He's warning his own disciples. Beware the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. What's the remedy? Well, he's already told us. It's where we began. Integrity. Personal integrity. That's the remedy. Your eye is the lamp of your body. If your eyes are sincere, your whole body is full of light. If they're bad, your body is full of darkness. See to it then that the light within you isn't darkness. That's Jesus' advice. I think Shakespeare was saying something very similar when he said, this above all, to thine own self be true. And it must follow as the night the day, thou canst not then be false to any man. Integrity. That's the remedy. But maybe you're saying to me, that's my problem. I'd like to have integrity, but I can't find it. Like that girl student, I'm conscious of the false images I project, the deceptive roles I play, but I can't discover the real me in it all. Don't you feel like that sometimes? I think many, many people do in our 20th century. Indeed, I suspect it may be the root of the human dilemma. We exist as self-conscious individuals only as a result of our relationships with other people. So how can we ever discover what we are in ourselves, independent of that moulding influence which others have upon us? Isn't that the problem of integrity? I think one of the most perceptive of our modern dramatists to express this is Harold Pinter. I don't know if you're familiar with any of his plays. But he is preoccupied with the elusiveness of the true self. There are some lines in one of his radio plays broadcast back in the 60s that illustrate it very well. Let me read it to you. "The point is," says Pinter, "who are you? Not why or how or even what, but who are you? Occasionally, I believe, I perceive a little of what you are, but that's pure accident. No, it's nothing like an accident. It's deliberate. It's joint pretense. We contrive the accident in order to continue. But who are you? How can I be certain of what I see? You're the sum of so many reflections. How many reflections? Whose reflections? Are reflections all that you consist of?" Isn't that the deepest fear of modern man? That at root there is no self to be true to. The scenery changes, the other actors change, and as a result the parts we play change. But we never leave the stage. We never stop acting. There is no role in our repertoire which is more authentically us than any other. Isn't that our great fear? We're just a kaleidoscope reflecting the images other people want to have of us. Hypocrisy is not so much a vice. It's the essence of our human condition. No, I tell you, it isn't so. Jesus would have us know it isn't so. I'm here this morning to tell you it's possible to find out who you really are. Yes, I'm here this morning, if you like, to point you to a relationship that rightly defines your true identity. I'm here to offer you a relationship with God. Don't you see why that's so important? You want to be delivered from this vicious cycle of hypocrisy and pretense? You want to find out the person you really are? Then you go home. You go to your room. You shut the door. And you talk to God. For the person you are there, when there's no crowd to watch or to applaud, and only God to hear, the person you are there is the person you really are. That's the person you will be for all eternity. That is the ultimate relationship that defines your identity. Things whispered in that secret place will one day be proclaimed on the housetops. We were made, you see, for that relationship. In its absence, our self-consciousness inevitably floats in a sea of lost identity. You and I will know who we are. We will identify the self we must be true to. Only when we are secure in our relationship with God. Till that day, doubt and hypocrisy will pursue us. It can't fail. There's one man I've come across, reading a bit, who I think grasped this in a very powerful way. Dietrich Bonhoeffer. Christian pastor, imprisoned by the Nazis during the last war. He suffered the torture of solitary confinement. And as a result of that being on his own, he also suffered the devastating assault of all those images of himself which he entertained and others entertained of him. And in his poem, Who Am I? He speaks of this fear of hypocrisy, his longing for that elusive integrity that we've been speaking about, but also of his discovery of the only place where it can really be found. Let me just read it to you. Who am I? They often tell me I would step from my cell's confinement calmly, cheerfully, firmly, like a squire from his country house. Who am I? They often tell me I would talk to my warders freely and friendly and clearly as though it were mine to command. Who am I? They often tell me I would bear the days of misfortune equably, smilingly, proudly, like one accustomed to win. Am I then really all that of which these other men tell of? Or am I only what I myself know of myself? Restless and longing and sick like a bird in a cage, struggling for breath as though hands were compressing my throat, yearning for colours, for flowers, for voices of birds, thirsting for words of kindness, for neighbourliness, tossing in expectation of great events, powerlessly trembling for friends at an infinite distance, weary and empty at praying, at thinking, at making, faint, and ready to say farewell to it all? Who am I? This or the other? Am I one person today and tomorrow another? Am I both at once? A hypocrite before others, and before myself a contemptible, woe-begone weakling. Who am I? They mock me, these lonely questions of mine. Whoever I am, thou knowest, O God, I am thine. That's the sentence, isn't it? Be gods. Be gods. In the solitary place, be gods. And I promise you, then you'll be able to be true to yourself. And then you'll have no more fear about being false to any man. Let's pray together.